Well, I don't know about all of you, but Sunday morning can be awfully hectic at our house. I mean, there's always a lot that needs to get done, especially when you got a family where they're going to all different churches. So, but my wife looked at me this morning and says, I finally figured out why you get so much more done on Sunday morning than I do. Says, you can take care of your hair grooming in under 5 seconds. Yeah, that's not fair, right? So, well, one of our staff members passed on to me a story about the Pope that I thought I would share with you. And this concerns his visit to Los Angeles. And he got picked up in a limo. But he had always wanted to drive a limo. So he kept talking to the driver, can I please drive this limo? And finally the driver said, sure, I'll let you drive the limo for a little while. So once he got behind the wheel, he decided to see what the limo could do. And got pulled over by one of L.A.'s finest. And the policeman looked into the window and then said, sir, do you realize you were doing 105? And he said, no. And said, then he says, I'm going to have to call my superior. So he calls his superior and says, you know, I just pulled over somebody really important. I mean, I think I got to let him go. And I said, well, how fast were they going? And he said, 105. And he says, I don't care how important they are, you give them the ticket. And he says, well, you know, this guy really is very important. And I said, well, is it the mayor? And he said, no, it's more important than the mayor. Is it the governor? No, more important than the governor. Well, I mean, who else could it be? Is it the president of the United States? And he said, no, you got to keep going up. And he says, look, I really think we've got to let this guy go. Because the chauffeur is the Pope. The guy's got to be God himself. So, with that, let's spend some time in Job 39. And, you know, as I shared last week, you know, Fuzz Ron and myself had spent 3 days in Dallas dialoguing with ministry leaders of young earth creationist organizations and old earth creationist organizations. And one thing I can share with you is that what I noticed there is something I've seen rather ubiquitously as I talk to young earth creationist leaders, is that none of them wants to concede that Job has anything to do with creation theology. Not Job 9, not Job 38, not Job 39. And but you know, as I continue to study this in teaching this material for this class, I've become convinced more and more as I study this stuff that there's no doubt that this is creation text. I mean, all of Job 39 that we're studying, all of Job 38 that focuses on creation. But I find it interesting that we have this battle going on within the Christian community. It's a battle over Genesis. And why can't we go to other creation texts in the Bible to seek some peace and resolution? But perhaps that's an area of strategy we can develop, is just to continue to encourage Christians to look at everything that the Bible's got to say about creation and see how it affects our interpretations of the creation texts in Genesis. And just by way of background, what we've been noticing here in Job 38 through to 42 is it follows the same basic pattern we see in Genesis 1, that pattern being that the text first deals with the creation that is strictly physical in nature. That's the first 4 creation days of Genesis chapter 1. And creation day 5 is the first time the text addresses the soulish creation, and not until the end of the 6th creation day does it deal with the one and only species on earth, that is body, soul, and spirit, the human species. Well, likewise, as we went through Job 38, we noticed that the entire text focused on the physical creation. That part of creation is strictly physical. And Job 39 is strictly focusing on the soulish creation. Everything in Job 39 is referring to the soulish animals that God created. And it's taking us one step beyond what we saw in Genesis chapter 1. It's actually identifying specific soulish animals that God created and using that as an argument that this is indeed the handiwork of God, evidence for His glory, His power, and His love, and especially His provision for the human species. One thing I've been trying to emphasize here is how a few of these soulish animals that are brought out in the text here in Job 39 are brought out because all of them have are evidence that God is creating all of this life before he created Adam and Eve for the benefit of the human species. All this is for us. Well, last week we talked about the ostrich and how, you know, people living in the 21st century really don't appreciate the huge role that ostriches played in launching human global population and civilization. And this week I was going to focus on verses 19 and following, verses 19 to 25, that talk about the horse and just what an amazing creature the horse is and what an amazing role the horse played in launching and sustaining human civilization. And let me just read the text, and I got a few cross-references for you as well. And by the way, I intend to stop at a certain point and talk to you about some new discoveries. Last week I didn't get to talk to you at all about the new discoveries. I got some I just aching to share with you. And actually one of them is relevant to this Job 39 text. So God's speaking here, but he is speaking from Job 38 all the way through to chapter 42. And he says, "Do you give the horse his strength, or clothe his neck with a flowing mane? You make him leap like a locust, striking terror with his proud snorting. He paws fiercely, rejoicing in his strength, and charges into the fray. He laughs at fear, afraid of nothing. He does not shy away from the sword. The quiver rattles against his side along with a flashing spear and lance. In frenzied excitement, he eats up the ground. He cannot stand still when the trumpet sounds. At the blast of the trumpet, he snorts. Aha! He catches the scent of battle from afar, the shout of commanders and the battle cry." So, what God has created for human beings is this animal of enormous strength with this flowing mane. Now you might say, what's the mane got to do with anything like this? Well, if you put yourself back in primitive times and you're trying to ride a horse, what are you going to grab onto? Okay, these days you got reins and stuff, but you know, put yourself in the context of time before that, and that mane did play a useful role in making it possible to domesticate a horse so you can ride it. I mean, we don't think of that today, but that's the way it goes. I was also reading this to my sons, and they said, "What's this fray business all about?" And, you know, this is, maybe that's why, I've heard they've got a new international version out. It's actually an update of the new international version. And what it does is it actually takes out some of these words and puts them in more contemporary language. The word fray means a fight. I had to explain it to my sons. They'd never seen the word before. So even in this new international version, we do get language that reminds us of the King James. But the thing that's amazing about this creature, it's emphasized throughout all this stuff, this is a creature that enjoys battle. And you say, you know, how do you explain that from an evolutionary perspective? Keep in mind this is a herbivore. When you look at herbivores and carnivores, the carnivores are the fighters. The herbivores are the ones that run away from fights. And yet here we have this horse who is a herbivore that actually seems to pursue danger and battle. You know, what's going on here? This just doesn't fit the evolutionary scenario at all. And when you look upon the face of the earth today, we actually have a lot of horse-like creatures. There's dozens of species that remind us of a horse. I mean, some of the more famous examples would be the zebra and the donkey. But zebras and donkeys do not share this quality of horses where they're easily tamed and can be ridden. I mean, notice with all the zebras in Africa, people aren't riding zebras around. Zebras don't take too well to being ridden. Donkeys do. But, you know, they're relatively small. A horse is great strength, and you can actually ride it. The other thing that's interesting about the horse, which is something we picked up last week about human beings. Remember talking about how human beings have a hunting advantage, the only hunting advantage they have, as they got the capacity to cool themselves. And it's because, you know, we are relatively tall, we're two-legged, we're thin, so we have a large surface area to body mass ratio, and we have this incredible perspiration system. So that's one advantage we have over other animals, is that we're able to cool ourselves quite efficiently as long as we got lots of water. Well, you may be interested to learn that horses, like human beings, are capable of sweating. And compared to other creatures, they also have a fairly, I mean, they're not like us. I mean, we are way beyond them in terms of surface area to body mass ratio. But horses are pretty decent compared to other animals, compared to, say, camels or elephants. You know, people have tried to take elephants into battle, but one of the problems is they have a rather low surface to body mass ratio, and therefore they don't have the endurance that a horse would have. But a horse is famous for endurance. You can ride a horse all day as long as you're able to give it adequate water. As long as you can keep that horse sweating, and that horse will, you can ride that horse all the time. You can't do that with a donkey. And a donkey doesn't have the strength of a horse. You might be able to ride a donkey, but you better not be very heavy, and you better not have a lot of gear with you. But the thing about horses is that you can actually not only ride them, you can take a lot of stuff with you. And that's the interesting thing about human beings. We always have baggage, right? No matter where human beings go, they have baggage. Well, a horse is able to take care of that for you. But the thing that this text is really bringing out is how the horse has this property that it can handle battle. It is extremely loyal to its rider. And if you've ever studied the history of cavalry, I did some reading on that this week. And one of the advantages of horses is they have a whole lot less fear of battle and the dangers and risks of battle than the riders do. And so this is one of the ways that generals would get their troops into battle. They'd put them on horses. You know, the horses would charge into battle. You're on top of the horse. I mean, you're part of the game. There you go. You're in the battle. And what they notice is that when you put troops on horses, they're much more less likely to flee the battle scene than if they're on foot. So the infantry you got to worry about. The ones that are on the horses, less of a concern because, you know, they're attached to the horse. And their capacity to escape the battle depends on the horse. And the horse is there ready to charge in. And if you've got a whole bunch of horses moving in, you're not going to get a horse breaking line and departing for the rear. That will happen with infantry. You can move a whole bunch of infantry into battle, and a few of them get frightened, and they decide to head for the rear. Very difficult to do that with a horse, because if you've got a few thousand horses moving into battle, you're not going to get a horse breaking ranks. Either all the horses retreat, or all the horses go forward. So it's one of the ways of keeping the troops in line. And this has been a major concern of generals throughout the ages. How do you get the troops to launch an attack? You know, launching an attack is dangerous. I mean, you're coming against this armed force, and they got lots of weapons, and you know, it takes a lot of courage to ride against a well-defended position. And also something in military annals is the fact that usually the losses of the attacker are typically three times that of the defender, unless, of course, you've got overwhelming advantage. So, I mean, if you're attacking with, say, a 4-to-1 ratio, you can keep the losses down. But if you're attacking with an equal ratio, then the losses of the attacker are much higher than they are the defender. Probably the most famous examples of that would be the Civil War and World War I. In those wars, the attacker always took the greatest punishment, and usually by far. But horses are one way to encourage the troops to withstand those kinds of losses. The horse isn't going to retreat. The guy on top of the horse might want to, but he's attached to the horse, and his capacity of escaping the injury without the horse is relatively low, so he tends to stick with the crowd and they get into the battle. So the horse doesn't have the fear, the riders do. He laughs at fear, afraid of nothing. He does not shy away from the sword. The quiver rattles against his side along with flashing spear and lance. Now, have you ever seen these movies? There's been several lately showing these cavalry charges into defended positions. And usually what the defenders do is that they will shoot a bunch of arrows or they raise up spears. But the amazing thing is, here are these horses looking at all these spears facing them, and they just keep going forward. Now, what is it that would make an animal do that? Now, my whole point here is this is extremely difficult to explain from an evolutionary perspective. I mean, evolution says survival of the fittest. And so a creature that winds up evolving genes by chance, where they really love to get killed in battle, probably isn't going to survive very long. But horses are designed to do that. And so this really goes against the evolutionary grain that you'd have these herbivorous creatures. I mean, again, the herbivores tend to be the fleers, not the attackers, that you have these herbivorous creatures who actually are prepared to show more courage in battle than the people riding on their backs. That and the fact that you've got a creature that has the capacity or the willingness to be ridden. I mean, that's not an easy thing to explain from an evolutionary perspective, that you would have creatures that would have the genes that would allow them to be domesticated by humans and then to be ridden in such a fashion they have all this weight. But horses have that capability. Not very many creatures do. I mean, I can think of the camel, the elephant, the donkey, the horse. That's about it in terms of creatures that will tolerate a human being being on their back. In fact, I would argue that in all four cases, this is something that really defies an evolutionary explanation. I mean, if you're talking about survival of the fittest, the last thing you want is somebody on your back with a whole bunch of baggage. I mean, that just doesn't, you know, fit the survival of the fittest mode. Yet we have creatures that are like that. And what it says here in verse 24, in frenzied excitement, he eats up the ground. He cannot stand still when the trumpet sounds. At the blast of the trumpet, he snorts a ha. He catches the scent of battle from afar, the shout of commanders and the battle cry. Now, I've had some conversations with my father. My grandfather was a horseman. He fought in both the Boer War and World War I and was very good with horses. In fact, I understand my grandfather had the reputation that if he had a good look at the horses before a horse race, he could pick up the winner, but refused to bet. He would never bet on the horses. He would never give anybody tips. But what he would do is he'd write on a piece of paper, and evidently he was always right. That's how well he knew horses. But this is something that he shared with my dad, how, you know, these horses actually anticipate battle. There is, you know, you get all these horses together and you're in a camp and the horses can't wait to get into the fray. Whereas the troops are all sitting there quivering in their boots and they're all praying, you know, and I hope the general keeps me in the rear or, you know, but not the horses. The horses, they just really look forward to this. And again, how do you explain this from an evolutionary perspective? I mean, they have a very high probability of being killed in this thing. And yet they really seem to enjoy. I mean, it's what my grandfather was sharing is this is the big, big excitement in life for a horse, is to be able to charge off into battle. They really seem to do that. And there's no other creature that really has this capacity, yes. Well, sure. I mean, for certain, early man domesticated the horse. But the fact that the horse, I mean, we've been able to domesticate the camel. We've been able to domesticate the donkey. But there's no way you're going to run into battle with 2,000 donkeys against a defended fortress. Donkeys do not have the temperament. I mean, you put them in danger, they head the opposite way no matter what you do to them. It's possible, but this is something that's been around in human culture from the very beginning, that they can do that. And by the way, let me tell you a little story. It's got nothing to do with battle. This again comes from my grandfather, and he was sharing with my dad about how it revolutionized the Canadian Indians when they got the white man's horse. Because what they were able to do was to ride this horse against these very well-armed buffalo. And this is the problem that the Plains Indians face, is that trying to hunt these buffalo was very difficult. Because the buffalo are really heavy creatures. I mean, they weigh a couple of thousand pounds, and they've got these enormous horns and this huge head. If you're not careful, you get killed. They run faster than you do, and so the only tactic that really worked was to try to scare them to fall over a cliff, or to try to isolate them where they could get their arrows into them, you know, pick off one of the young ones or the sick one. But with a horse, they were able to efficiently hunt the buffalo. And why? Because the horse was not afraid of those buffalo horns. Now, the buffalo is bigger than the horse, and a buffalo can do a lot of damage to the horse, but for some reason the horse shows no fear. And that again kind of fits in with the text here. You know, God has designed the horse in such a way that it shows no fear. The other factor, and again this comes through my grandfather, is that horses amongst all domesticated animals, well, maybe the dog's an exception, show incredible loyalty to their owner. And so, you know, we got people in this class here who own horses. And that's one of the things about a horse, is that a horse will form a lifelong bond with its owner and is extremely loyal to that owner. And it's been known in battle, for example, where the guy on the horse will be injured and the horse will stick by that person until help comes. The horse will not abandon that person in spite of the dangers that might exist. I mean, there may be gunshots going all around, or, you know, shells exploding. That horse will not leave its injured owner. It will stick right there with him. Yeah. Well, a dog has a fairly high IQ. I wouldn't be surprised that a dog's IQ is superior to that of a horse. Although I've heard that horses aren't all that dumb. They're a lot smarter than cows, for example. But one of the properties they have is this extreme loyalty. And, you know, that's an advantage when you're facing a good prospect of injury in battle. Have a horse that stick with you. There's even been cases where horses will lie down beside the injured person and keep them warm until help comes along. So it's kind of like a dog. I mean, a dog will stick with you no matter what. A horse is another creature that will stick with you no matter what. A dog you can shoo off by firing shots at it. A horse you won't. The horse will stick no matter what. So a horse actually shows a higher degree of loyalty under danger than the dog does. Yes. Well, that's what people have often said. You know, donkeys are smarter than horses because when there's a risk, they'll leave the risk, whereas a horse will stay behind and get killed. But what I'm suggesting is that there's something supernatural about the way God has designed horses that it can fit this role. And this is a role that's been helpful for humanity throughout the ages. Not just in terms of battle, but as I pointed out, in terms of being able to hunt creatures. If you're on horseback, you can take that horse and pit it against the most dangerous animal that you care to hunt, and the horse will stick with you and will actually charge into the fray so that you can kill that buffalo. There's really no other creature that would be willing to do that. Yes. Well, you're asking a different question. How did God program? I mean, in fact, you can ask that about all these animals. We've been talking about goats and deer and the ostrich, and they're all programmed differently. You know, the ostrich is this animal that doesn't really care for its age. And that just seems so out of whack with everything else we see with birds. You know, how did God program these creatures to have these radically different behaviors? Easy question, easy answer is, I don't know. Okay, people have looked for it in the genes. It doesn't seem to be in the genes, but people call it instinct. But where's the software? So far, scientists have not been able to discover where that software lies. I mean, the common answer is the genes, but nobody's ever been able to find a battle gene for the horse. Well, that's very much true, and I'm sure that's a huge factor when they're being used for battle or for hunting, is the fact that they're able to communicate at an emotional level with human beings so well. So, and in terms of their intelligence, you know, the bonds that they form with human beings are so strong, you can train them to do virtually anything they're physically capable of doing, which is kind of the example you raised. They really want to please their human owner. But I think your point is valid. They have this capacity to read. And, you know, I've noticed that because I live in San Dimas, which is kind of a horse town. Just a block from where we live, there's a big stable with all kinds of horses. And, you know, when I go on one of my runs, I run by all these horses, and they haven't seen me before, but they're able to read, you know, kind of my emotions. And the thing I've noticed is you get these horses that I've never had contact with before, and they want some contact with me. They'll actually, you know, there'll be a rider on board, and the horse stops and turns around, comes towards me, so I got to stroke the horse a little bit, and then we can both go on our way. You know, that's an unusual behavior. Dogs are like that. Horses are like that. I don't know of any other creatures that are like that. Cats aren't like that. So it seems to be unique to these dogs and horses, and it's dogs and horses that we human beings have formed these tight bonds with and are able to use in ways we can't use other animals. You know, a dog is similar. You can train a dog to do virtually anything it's physically capable of doing. Why? Because of how powerful its emotional bond is with its owner. Same thing with a horse. Now, there's some other comments. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's something that you will see in literature is that, you know, here's an elephant that you can take into battle or a horse that you can take into battle, but some little creature that would be no threat to them at all. You know, the classic stories of the mouse, but, you know, a coyote is in no way going to be a threat to a horse. And yet they can be spooked by a coyote. They can be spooked by a raccoon or a snake. And yet they're prepared to charge into battle where there's 10,000 spears spacing and all kinds of arrows. They'll do that. But, you know, they'll be afraid of something like that. So, but, yeah, that's a good point about human beings. We're so dumb that we'll charge into battle, too. But the point I was making is it seems like God has programmed a horse to have even less fear of battle than we human beings have. And, you know, and generals have taken advantage of this in wars ever since the beginning. There's one cross-reference I wanted to share with you, and it goes back to Deuteronomy 17, verse 16. And this is the Levitical law, and Moses is laying out some laws for the people to obey. And now he's laying out some laws for the king, starting in verse 14. It says, "When you enter the land the Lord your God has given you, and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, 'Let us set a king over us like all the nations around us,' be sure to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses. He must be from among your own brothers. Do not place a foreigner over you who is not a brother Israelite." Now here's the verse, verse 16. "The king, moreover, must not acquire a great number of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. For the Lord has told you, you're not to go back that way again." Now, as you read on in the text, we note that, in the historical text, that the Israelite kings basically followed that command. They violated lots of the other commands about kings, but this is one they tended to keep. They did not accumulate horses. The one exception to that was Solomon. Solomon did accumulate a large number of horses, but the rest of the kings did not. And the kings after Solomon, likewise, did not accumulate horses. Solomon was the one exception. Now, say, what's the intent behind all of this? Well, the text here mentions Egypt. Don't accumulate horses, because Egypt's where you're going to have to go to get them. I don't want you to go back that way again because of the problems you had there in Egypt in the past. I don't want you to follow the practice of the Egyptians. But there's more to it than that. You know, God was setting up the Jews as a people, putting in the junction of three continents. And the whole intent was, this is the days before Roman roads and any kind of decent transportation technology. The way the gospel was going to be spread was through caravan traders going through this junction of three continents and making contact with the people of God and taking the message back home with them. For that missionary strategy to be effective, it was critical that the Jews not be aggressive peoples or not be an aggressive nation. And so God's intent was that the Israelites would retain a defensive posture politically and militarily, not an offensive posture. And that's really what's behind the command, do not accumulate large number of horses. And by the way, if you read on in the text, it also makes a command about chariots, how the king is not to build up a large force of chariots. And chariots and horses are what you use for offense, at least in ancient times. And so by having the king not accumulate large number of horses and chariots, that would limit the offensive capability of the Israelites and keep them in a defensive position, which is the best strategy for bringing about the spread of the gospel in the days before effective transportation technology. You know, that's really a theme what we see in the New Testament. Jesus Christ comes to planet Earth at the very beginning of where it's possible to spread the gospel by other means. And you know, people say, why did Jesus come when he did? Well, he came at the first point in human history where there was relatively efficient transportation systems where people could leave their homeland and take the gospel with them. Before that, the strategy was to have the peoples come to them. And that's why I believe God told Abraham to leave the land of Mesopotamia and to settle in the land of Canaan. Canaan's a junction of three continents, which would force all the peoples of the world to have some contact with them, at least as the traders have passed through the land. But that also explains why they were not to accumulate large number of horses. Also explains why a judgment may have come upon Solomon. By the way, there are those who speculate that the horses that Solomon accumulated also had something to do with the wives that he accumulated. To get all these horses, he had to make deals and treaties with other nations. And one of the ways that Solomon kept all those treaties was through marrying foreign wives, which led to the spiritual collapse of the kingdom and the split up of the kingdom. So, a little bit about horses there. And by the way, there's probably a whole lot more about horses you can pull this text. I'm not an expert on horses, so yes. Yeah, that's right. That's a good psalm. Making the point that there are those who put their hope in horses. I think there's another psalm that also talks about those who put their hope in young men with strong legs. That again would be a reference to battle. How, you know, when a king was trying to figure out how to put together an army, they usually would have foot races. And whoever won the foot races got into the army or got into the best regiments of the army. And so those psalms that talk about kings or peoples who put their faith and confidence in young men with strong legs or in their horses, this again is a reference to people who are putting their confidence or their security in the strength of their army rather than the strength of the Lord to defend them in battle and in danger. So I think that's part of what Deuteronomy 17 is all about. That's a command to the Israelites. You're to put your faith and confidence and security in me, not in the size of the offensive army that you can develop. And when it comes to battle, I will defend you. But I'm not there to help you expand an enormous empire. I'm there to defend you. And by the way, God had set up limits as to how big the Israelite kingdom could become. And King David took it to those limits, and there was the concern that Solomon was trying to take it past those limits. And so things happened to Solomon to prevent him from expanding the borders of Israel. King David had expanded them to the biblical limits, which was basically the Wadi of Egypt to the Euphrates. It couldn't be any bigger than that. Okay, what I want to do, by the way, next week we're going to talk about the hawk and the eagle, which will close out our discussion of chapter 39, and just about the interesting characteristics that the hawk and the eagle have that teaches some things about God. And I just want to emphasize again that Job 39 is simply picking out a few of the soulish animals. I'd like to suggest that a message that God is bringing about here is he's simply picking up those soulish animals that these five men that are debating one another would have the most familiarity with. They would be familiar with the goats, the horses, the ostriches. These are creatures that they knew and studied. But I'd like to suggest that what God is laying out here is a principle that he has programmed and designed every nephesh creature, every bird, every mammal, every one of the higher reptiles, to demonstrate by their characteristics God's power and glory and the righteousness in creation, but also how each of these creatures has been designed and programmed to serve mankind in some way. So all of this is designed to preach to the human race that God exists and that God is there to provide for them. And these are just a few examples that God is picking out. The horse, the donkey, the ostrich, the ox, the deer, the goat. And next week we'll talk about the hawk and the... By the way, I believe that verses 16 and following, where it talks about the hawk and the eagle, is actually addressing a whole category of carnivorous birds, because it talks about the birds that actually feed on carrion. So that's probably a reference to, what do you call those birds that feed on carrion? Vultures as well. Okay, what I want to do is switch gears for a little bit. Not exactly switch gears. This is a a discovery that was published in the latest issue of Science, and has to do with pigs. And you say, how do pigs fit into Job 39? Well, pigs are one of these creatures that is a soulish animal. It's got mind, will, and emotions. And this paper in Science, first of all, talks about the place where pigs were first domesticated. And very interestingly, it dates back to about 9,000 years ago, and the point of domestication is what they call Eastern Anatolia. But Eastern Anatolia, basically Eastern Turkey, is that same region where we see the first instance of goat domestication 10,000 years ago. Basically northwest Mesopotamia, which I believe is the best geographical location, highest probability geographical location for the landing of Noah's Ark. And we see after Noah's Ark lands, there's this rapid spread of humanity and the development of civilization and technology. But as interesting as the archaeologists dig into the origins of human civilization, it seems like everything starts in northwest Mesopotamia. That's the birthplace of goat domestication. It's the birthplace of wheat domestication. It's the first place where pottery manufacture takes place. It's the first place where you got towns and cities developing. And now we discover it's the first place where you got the pig domestication going on. But what this paper really digs into is how yet we have this location of the first goat domestication taking place in northwest Mesopotamia, but it also gives a map, and this is kind of how it looks. I don't know whether you can see it. They kind of got a color map here showing all the different places in the world within a few centuries after 9,000 years ago, where a pig domestication takes off. And so what they're documenting here is not only do we have an early origin for goat domestication that begins in northwest Mesopotamia, this is evidence that there's been a very rapid spread of humanity from that region of the world, and everywhere where people spread, they domesticated the wild boars that were there. Now, how they made this discovery was interesting. They basically looked at mitochondrial DNA in wild boar all over Eurasia. And then they looked at mitochondrial DNA of domesticated pigs all over Eurasia. This would be Europe, Asia, and Africa. And what they discovered is that you can see in both the domesticated pigs and the wild boars that there must have been at least 7 points where the domestication of pigs took place after that first domestication that took place in Mesopotamia. So what this is demonstrating is that there seemed to be this simultaneous launch of domestication that took place all over Eurasia. Now then, remember we talked about in the class here how there was this event that took place about 8,000 years ago that brought about the halt of the next ice age, and how the next ice age should have begun about 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. But because of the very well-timed launch of human civilization all over Eurasia about 8,000 years ago, humanity was able to delay the onset of the next ice age. Now we're still benefiting from that to this day. I mean, the climate's been warm for 6,000 years more than it should have been warm. And that's enabled us to sustain global human civilization globally and build up the technology that we have. I don't think we ever would have gotten to a high-tech civilization if we had entered the Ice Age 5,000 years ago. It just wouldn't have happened. And this is more evidence for the fact that there was this simultaneous launch of civilization virtually all over Europe, Asia, and Africa beginning about 8,000 years ago. So, for what it's worth, I think that's kind of an interesting discovery, how God is in control of when civilization is launched. And just to kind of emphasize that point, need to understand that the best scientific and biblical dates for the birth of humanity, the creation of humanity, is about 50,000 years ago, give or take 15,000 years. And one of the questions I've often puzzled over is why did it take so long for global human civilization to be launched? I mean, you've got 40,000 years when not a whole lot happens. The population remains small, and we basically have a hunter-gatherer type economy going on for all those tens of thousands of years. Yet people back then were just as smart as people are today, maybe a little smarter. And yet it wasn't until 8,000-9,000 years ago that we actually saw global human civilization launch. I like to suggest because that is the ideal time to launch it. Launching it earlier or launching it later would have caused problems in terms of building up a global high technology civilization that would facilitate the completion of the Great Commission, taking the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the peoples of the world. Okay. One more discovery that I want to share with you. Yeah, question? Okay, good question. What was man doing all that time? Well, I think that was a puzzle that must have hit the first white men that settled in North America. They ran into these Indians and later the Eskimos. And what they discovered is these Indians and Eskimos were living at a zero growth in terms of their technology for thousands of years. And yet North America is resource rich. I mean, you'd think the easiest place to launch civilization would be North America, yet it didn't happen. All the resources here, all the great farmland, all the trees, the fishing, it just didn't happen. Well, one of the analysis of historians is that the reason it didn't happen is that life was too good here. You know, the Indians could work an hour a day and they had all they needed. And, you know, working 1 hour a day and having 23 hours of leisure sounds like a pretty good lifestyle. So, maybe that's what kept it. But I think another reason that may have kept things from really getting developed here is you really don't see the domestication of animals taking place amongst the Indians and the Eskimos. And one of the things that happened here in North America, by the way, North America, before human beings came here, there were horses, there were camels, there were elephants. They were all wiped out. There were lions and tigers here. But they were all wiped out by the initial migration of human beings from Siberia into North America and South America. And they were wiped out quickly. In like 1,000 to 1,500 years, all these creatures, the last to disappear were the elephants, what they call a mastodon. A few of them survived up in the north, but by about 3 to 4,000 years ago, the last of the mastodons was killed off. But the horses were wiped out immediately. And again, we're talking about that here in the text. The fact that the early migrators of into North and South America quickly killed off all the horses really limited their capacity to launch civilization. They couldn't hunt for buffalo effectively. The transportation was limited. They couldn't get places very quickly. You know, a horse is a terrific animal for sending mail to one another. It's hard to do that with a donkey. At least very quickly, but with a horse, you know, it can sweat, and you can set up a pony express, or you know, just have a horse run all day and keep it well watered, and you can get good communication going amongst people. One of the things you notice about the Indians is they had very limited contact. And it's false, correct? By the way, there's a book that may even be on our table there. If not, it's in our warehouse. At our Reasons to Believe office. It's a new book we're carrying about how DNA evidence disproves Mormon theology. You know, the Mormons claim, for example, that there was this migration of Israelites to North America a couple of thousand years ago and even earlier. Well, if that were really true, that would show up in the DNA of modern Indians. And that DNA evidence has been looked at and shows us that the Mormon claim is utterly false. There's no way that the American Indian has any DNA from a Jewish line. It's just not there. Not to mention the fact that nobody's ever found any of these coins that the Book of Mormon talks about, or the swords. I mean, if you read the Mormon scriptures, it talks about how long before the white man came, the Indians had these steel scimitars and had this coin system, had these cities, and these huge battles where millions would fight one another in battle. Zero archaeological evidence for any of that. But I remember going door to door just sharing the Christian faith years ago. I used to do that when I was a full-time minister of evangelism. And quite often we run into Mormons when we would go door to door. And I had this friend, lived here in Sierra Madre, was an elder in his church years ago. And he has this collection of biblical coins. And you know, he's got everything. And I said, you know, where did you get these? And he says, oh, I just bought them. I didn't get them from a museum. I just went up and bought them on the open market. So he has this little collection here. So I was able to share with my Mormon friends, gee, I have a friend who has all these biblical coins. Why don't you show me one of your coins? Well, we don't have any. Well, are there any museums that have collections? No. And yet there are millions of people distributing coins all over North America, and we don't have a single coin that we can dig up today. Nothing. And what about these scimitars? I mean, you know, steel preserved quite well. And surely there's a scimitar somewhere. Do you have one in your private collection? Well, no, but, you know, people do have swords that date back to the time of the Romans in their private collection. So you can use that as evidence. But now we have the DNA evidence, which is very convincing. Yes. Drive them from Mormonism. And I found this with Muslims as well, is that there are many Muslims out there, just as there are many Mormons, who know that what their holy book teaches is not true, but that they were committed to stick with it anyway because of the social benefits. And really, when you talk to them about the social benefits, it really gets down to social penalties. If you leave the Mormon church, you may wind up losing your family, your job, and all of your friends. Just like... Oh yeah, plant the seed. I mean, there are Mormons out there who really think that there's some factuality behind their faith. Just like there are Muslims out there who think there's some factuality behind their faith. And it's very helpful to show them that, you know, are you going to trust your life to something that you know is not true? Is that really a wise thing to do? And sure, there may be some social consequences to this, but, I mean, we're talking eternity, not just the next few decades. And when you stack up eternity against the next few decades, but what do the scriptures say? Following Christ means you have to be prepared to leave your family, to leave your position of status. You need to make him number one in your life. That's what becoming a Christian is all about. But I would share with this with people door to door. Giving your life to Christ is saying to everyone you know that Jesus Christ is the most important person in my life. And if you're not prepared to do that, you're not ready to become a Christian. And that's why it says we're to confess them before men. If you're embarrassed about being a Christian before people, then you're really not ready to give your life to Christ at this point. And, you know, that's something that is helpful to share with Muslims and with Mormons. That's a real struggle that they're facing. But keep in mind that for a lot of them, the social penalties are much more severe than they are for us. You know, I was not disenfranchised by my mother and father when I became a Christian. They were disappointed, and they thought I'd thrown my career away, but they did not tell me I wasn't welcome to come home at Christmas or Thanksgiving. Whereas, you know, my friend David Block, who's down in Africa, as an Orthodox Jew, when he gave his life to Christ, his family held a funeral for him and said, we'll never have any more contact with you. This is it forever. You know, that's tough. So sometimes it's helpful just to, and when they become aware that it's not true, to say, well, maybe you need to re-examine the social advantages. Now, I ran into this one Mormon physicist, and he said, look, I don't need you talking to me to realize this stuff isn't true. He said, I know none of it's true. But he said, you know, look at this social structure we have as Mormons. And, you know, look at all the money we give to support the poor. And so sometimes it's helpful just to probe that a little bit and say, well, I mean, what about the social advantages of being a Christian? You know, and this is not well known by Mormons, but evangelical Christians give far more to the poor, give far more to social causes than the Mormons do. I think one of the reasons why it looks so good in Mormonism, they only recruit those that have good jobs. And so, you know, their social program doesn't require a lot of financial support because the people they're trying to bring into the Mormon faith are people that have good jobs in the first place. That and the fact that they go door to door to collect the tithe. I don't think we do that here at Sierra Madre Congregational Church. I've never gotten a visit from an elder saying, you know, we've calculated what your income should be and we're here to collect the part that you didn't give. I mean, that hasn't happened. Well, Bertrand, the real problem there is that if you've got a galaxy in your vicinity, galaxies have a lot of mass. And because of their mass, they can disturb the dynamics of stars orbiting around the center of the galaxy. What's critical for life on planet Earth is that our sun have this very stable orbit at the just right distance from the center of the galaxy. If we don't have that stable orbit, then, what will happen is this. We're halfway up from the center of the galaxy, which is where you want to be to have the right metals to make life possible, and then we're in between two spiral arms. And you want to stay in between two spiral arms. You don't want to get near the spiral arms. And that requires that we be at what's called the co-rotation distance from the center of the galaxy, where our star goes around the center of the galaxy at the same rate that the spiral structure rotates. Now, if you've got a nearby galaxy, that nearby galaxy will, through its gravity, pull on the orbits of the stars going around the galaxy. And so the orbits of those stars will be moved from where they were. And that movement is going to take the sun out of what's called the galactic habitable zone. You know, it's a very narrow width of orbital distance from the center of our galaxy where life is possible. So that's why you don't want any big galaxies around. Another reason why you don't want big galaxies around is big galaxies tend to have really gigantic black holes at their center. And because they're big, they're sucking in dwarf galaxies that are in their vicinity. And when they do, it fires up the synchrotron engine just outside the black hole, and that synchrotron engine will blast all of galactic and intergalactic space with radiation that would be deadly for life. So it's a good thing that our local group has no big galaxies in it. The biggest galaxy is the Andromeda Galaxy, which is only slightly bigger than ours. But when you look at photos of clusters of galaxies, virtually every one of them has several giant galaxies. And if you're in a cluster of galaxies where you've got giant galaxies, there's no possibility of life. And you don't want the galaxies too close together. Right, but it has to be tuned in another way. You want to make sure that the grouping of galaxies you're in has a fairly large number of dwarf galaxies. What keeps our spiral galaxy a spiral is that every once in a while it gobbles up a small dwarf galaxy. And if it's not gobbling up those dwarf galaxies, that means there won't be the gas infusion to sustain spiral structure. And when the spiral structure collapses, that will collapse the orbit of the sun. So you want to be in the just right grouping of galaxies, and we happen to be in just such a group. We have about 24 dwarfs left. But, you know, billions of years ago, there were hundreds of dwarf galaxies in the local group. Now there's only a couple of dozen left. So that means that in the relatively near future, and you may want to take this into account in your investment strategies, our Milky Way galaxy is going to run out of dwarfs to suck in to sustain its spiral structure. And that will be the end of life possibility in our galaxy. And that's going to happen in a couple billion years. Okay. No. It's only billions, not millions. So yeah, you don't have to worry too much about your investment. It's just billions. Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, today we extol the American Indian as one who really cares for the environment and is kind of with the land and is the real ecologist. But look what they did 12,000 years ago. They came to North America, wiped out all the tigers, lions, camels, horses, and elephants, and put themselves in a really dire position. So, but maybe that caused them to repent and reform. And maybe we guys with white skin need to look at the Indians and say, well, they repented, maybe we need to repent too. However, I wouldn't draw the line at worshiping the land, which is what a number of American Indian groups are trying to do, is promote an alternate religion. Pardon me? There you go. Okay. One more discovery before we run out of time. And this is a group of Chinese astronomers. What these Chinese astronomers did is they looked at what are called Type 1A supernovae. Now, I've talked a little bit about this before. Type 1A supernovae are the yardstick for measuring the age of the universe, the expansion of the universe, where we get our strongest evidence for the supernatural design. There's nowhere else in science where you get stronger evidence for supernatural design than we do in the density parameters that govern the expansion of the universe. But fundamentally, in terms of measuring this, it depends on these Type 1A supernovae. And why Type 1A supernovae? These are called standard candles. They're extremely bright stars that all have the same brightness. And the principle here is that you've got this large star that's being orbited closely by another star. And the second star is close enough to the big star that the big star's gravity is able to steal mass from the small star onto itself. And so it happens as these two stars are orbiting around one another, the bigger star gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, the theory of general relativity tells us that when an old star that's virtually run out of its nuclear fuel exceeds 1.4 times the mass of our star, the Sun, it will go supernova. And so what happens is the star that is, say, 1.2 times the mass of our Sun keeps growing and growing and growing. It hits 1.4, and it's like a match. It sets off a bomb, and you get this supernova explosion. But the principle of supernova explosions is this. The greater the mass, the greater the luminosity. So there are single stars out there that go supernova when they have 20 times the mass of the Sun. And therefore, they're very much brighter than a star that's 1.4 times the mass of the Sun. But there's no way a star is going to go supernova unless it has at least 1.4 times the mass of the Sun. Now, we call these Type 1A supernova standard candles because we know that these supernova that accumulate mass by stealing mass from a partner star all have the same mass when they explode. Therefore, they have the same brightness. And if a star has the same brightness, then that means we can simply measure the brightness of the supernova, and that will tell us how far away it is. And we know how far away it is, then we can measure the recession velocity, look at the spectra to see how much it is redshifted, and that gives us its velocity. If we know the distance and the velocity, then we know the expansion of the universe at that distance or that look-back time in the history of the universe. But lately, astronomers have become aware that this identification of Type 1A supernova as strict standard candles is not quite warranted. And the problem here is this, that you've got this star stealing mass from another star, and it depends how efficiently that mass is being dumped onto the other star, whether it's 1.4 times the mass of the Sun when it explodes, or 1.41 times the mass of the Sun when it explodes. You say, what difference does a hundredth of a 1% make? It actually makes a lot of difference, because the luminosity of a star goes up with a fourth power of its mass. So if there's a 1% or a 2% discrepancy in the ignition of one of these Type 1A supernova, that makes a difference of many percent, 10 to 15% actually, in the brightness of the star. That explains why astronomers have not been able to pin down through their measurements the expansion history of the universe with any greater precision than 10 to 15%. Okay, that's where this discovery comes along. A team of five Chinese astronomers has said we have found a way to determine exactly how bright these Type 1A supernova are. What they did is they looked at hundreds of examples of Type 1A supernova and tried to see if they could find any correlations that might be helpful. And they found one. I'm going to try to show you this on the board. Now, what that factor of five improvement is going to do for us is allow us to determine with high precision how rapidly the universe is expanding from the creation event forward all the way up to the present, 13.7 billion years worth. We can pick it up starting about a billion years after the creation event, all the way up to the present day. And astronomers are very interested in that because they're trying to determine if there's a third factor governing the expansion of the universe. We're now well aware that dark energy is a dominant factor, gravity is a second factor based on the mass, but there's some hints that there may be a third factor. In fact, the latest measurement, and this technique hasn't been exploited yet, but the measurements that are good to about 10 to 11% demonstrate that the universe shows expansion under a constant dark energy parameter for about the past 6 to 7 billion years. But previous to that, it looks like there's a slow variation that we're not able to figure out what's responsible for. But if that slow variation shows up, and see, the 10 to 15% is not enough to confirm that slow variation in the first 8 billion years of the universe's history, 2 to 3% is going to be able to nail that down. Whether or not there's a slow variation or whether or not we're fooling ourselves and thinking we're seeing a slow variation. If we pick up that slow variation as real, that will tell us there's a third factor governing the expansion of the universe early in its history, and a third factor will give us another piece of evidence for supernatural design of the universe. Frankly, I think it's going to show up there because there is a way you really want to get the expansion going a little more rapidly than you would with only the two parameters, early in the history of the universe. And a lot of the data is showing us that there's a jump start in the buildup of metals very early in the universe. The third factor would explain that. And if it's not that third factor, it's something else. So what I'm just sharing with you, I think we're on the verge of seeing another jump and the evidence for supernatural design as we look at the history of the universe. Another reason why God placed us in this local group of galaxies. Only if you're in the local group of galaxies are able to see all the way back to the creation event. If you're any other cluster of galaxies, your view would be blocked. And by the way, if we were created any other time in cosmic history, we wouldn't be able to see the whole history of the universe. Any later, any earlier, you see only a limited part of the history of the universe. I think God wanted us to see the whole picture so we could pick up all this amazing evidence in these last days. For that, we're out of time. Next time, we'll finish up Job 39 and jump into Job 42. You say, what are we going to do with Job 40 and 41? Well, if you remember, it's about, what, a year and a half ago we covered that? Or a year ago, I guess it was. So I'll give you a quick review of 40 and 41 just to pick up what we discussed a year ago. And we'll finish off with Job 42. And then we're going to launch into the creation accounts of the Book of Psalms. There's several in the Book of Psalms that are really quite exciting. And the ones in the Psalms really complement the ones we see here in the Book of Job. Father in heaven, thank you that there's all this creation material that you put in the text for us. Father, I pray as we study this that we would not only build our apologetic tool chest for demonstrating to people who don't know you yet that there really is a God out there, a God that is powerful and wise and loving and desires to form a relationship with Him. But Father, I pray as we look at these texts that we would learn something about ourselves and something about the way you designed us to relate to one another and to relate to you. In Jesus' name. Amen.